We prayed tonight for life, for a full year of life and more for ourselves, for our loved ones. We prayed tonight for joy and for blessing in the new year. The more innocent among us have spent this hour planning their good times, savoring the delights that await tomorrow. The more sober among us have curbed our imaginations, for we know that each year is woven of the same stuff, a multicolored thread, alternately bright and gray. It is as the poet said, time heals all wounds, but deals us fresh blows with its scythe. Life is the blessing, but it is often a bruising blessing. Life is all that we have. Is infinitely precious to us. But oh, it's so brief, so uncertain, and the way is often painful. Sometimes we must muster and clutch every ounce of strength we possess simply to carry on. Life is a kaleidoscope, confusion. So quite naturally on a day such as this, we pray for the wisdom to use life wisely. And so quite naturally on a day such as this, our fathers advised us to consider again the mystery that is life, to ponder its conundrums and its riddles, to seek for its understanding. And I would follow this evening this ancient way. There is no solution to the riddle of life, but every approach has its merit, every understanding gained its advantage. And I would propose that we approach life this evening by unfolding two of the classic illustrations of life from the literature. The one illustration is Greek, the other is Jewish. Greek literature tells of a tyrant of Syracuse by the name of Diogenes, who was the very model of a Greek autocrat. Now, in a tyrant's court, all honor and all opportunity depend upon the whim of the ruler. And the courtiers quickly develop the lackey's arts of flattery and sycophancy. And at this particular court, none was more agile in the flatterer's art than a certain Damocles. He boasted even that he could bend the mood of the king to suit his fancy. But Diogenes was no fool. And one day he summoned this courtier, Damocles, to a banquet. He sat him in the seat of honor. He plied him with compliment and with attention and with all manner of dainty and delicacy. But Damocles enjoyed himself not one whit. For as he was being seated, his eye looked up and he saw dangling above his head evil, murderous sword hanging there by a single slender thread. Now, ever after in that court, no courtier boasted that he had Diogenes in his pocket, that he could bend him around his little finger. But the importance of this legend as it passed into Greek literature and became the classic text of the simple truth, there is no security this side of the grave. Each of us, in a certain way, is Damocles. When life is comfortable, we become expansive and good-natured about it all. We look on the home that we have built and the opportunity which is ours as rather solidly founded. Nothing can shake us. How wrong we are. We rather pride ourselves in such moments on the ease in which we make friendships, or on the important connections that we have with certain people of quality. And some there be who pride themselves on their good looks and on the size of their supposed inheritance. And of course, there are among us those of far more substantial accomplishment. Men and women who have honed their talents finely, who can give to the world in beauty and in art things of quality and in merit. Men and women of professional competence, which is first rate, who have every reason to be proud of their investment of time and discipline. Whether our achievements be substantial or trivial, one truth remains of them all. Above us, there hangs a sword. We can be stripped of our achievements, of all that we possess in an instant. A sudden, unexpected, crippling disease. The screech of rubber biting to break upon the wet cement too late. A merger, a manager told to pair the personnel, a change in the policies of the nation, and some men must go into exile, and some boys must go off to war. Each man is Damocles. This world gives us no guarantee. There is no guarantee that there will be for us a tomorrow. Certainly no guarantee that that tomorrow will be woven of the golden stuff of our dreams. Our world is not even a fair world. It does not reward decency and honor always. It does not even protect the innocent. Reliability, moderation, learning, loyalty, and love have been the hallmarks of the Jewish people for thousands of years, and our reward has been almost universal calumny. In half the world today, the reward for independence of spirit is the prisoner's cell. And in Mississippi, just this week, a young boy was beaten to a bloody pulp, his leg broken, his crime, he obeyed the state and his parents, and he went to school. There is a sword over our heads. The Greeks insisted that we must return again and again to this image of the Damoclean sword. Why? Because each of us is a liar. We lie to ourselves. Each of us is a fabricator. We imagine great fancies. We are afraid to look at life as it is in the raw. And so we shut our eyes and we close our ears and we build a neat world of fancy and illusion. And what a terrible price we often pay for these illusions, for the more vaulting our expectations, the more shattering the fall. How few of us dares to see life for what it is, uncertain, raw, cruel, brutal. Each of us is Damocles. What fact is more ordinary than the intrusion of death? Who is there so innocent that he has not come across death? And yet did not each of us know those overly gentle folk who build a wall of verbal circumlocutions and euphemisms around the fact of death? There is no death. He has passed on. and they pretty up the corpse to give the illusion of life. As if death cannot intrude into their world of reality. And each of us knows also the grasshopper people who play and who procrastinate and who put off, who assume somehow that youth will remain with them in vigor and strength and beauty and all of it to the very edge of the grave. Now, I used to simply tick off these people as shallow and as selfish. But I believe it goes deeper. They're blind. Or rather, they have blinded themselves to the most universal of truths. The certainty of death and the uncertainty of its timing. And the tragedy is that when death reaches in its chill hand into their home, and touches them deeply, it is precisely these overly romantic folk, these grasshopper people who whine and who complain, who feel themselves particularly chosen by God for torture. Why me? They cry. Why not? We're all mortal. The grace of grief and the strength to live comes only to those who have accepted life with all of its privation, of all of its limitation, for what it is. Those of us who have the naive, childish notion that we are center stage and all the world revolves around us, that it's a child's world doting upon us, we're in for a rude shock and a rude awakening, and the psychology has told us there are many who refuse to awaken. Who were once having seen the power, the raw power of the world, draw back into a private dream world, a tragedy, all their own. Each of us is Damocles. How busy we are, all of us, drawing about ourselves some philosophy of confidence. We say to ourselves, the headlines may be black, the future may seem uncertain, but mankind will manage, will muddle through. We always have. We poo-poo the prophets who speak of the probability of another war or the possibility of the dissolution of civilization. And when I push the optimist for his proof, he speaks to me of the power of reason. He speaks to me of the promise of education. He speaks to me of the benefits of the products of our science. But I'm wondering all the time if he is not speaking to keep up the facade of his own courage. For on what does he base this confidence? Where is the evidence that mankind has come into a new degree of courage and of moral vision, that he has broken once and for all the cycle of greed and cupidity which has given us the recurrent wars and devastations of the past? Some of us, I'm afraid, make the mistake of confusing the heights for the world. The easy confraternity of people of relative abundance with the bitter struggle for survival of three quarters. Perhaps we can excuse ourselves. This is the world that we know, the world with which we're familiar. But is it really? So many of us lived through or grew up in the abject poverty of the Depression. And many of us fought in the most barbarous of all world wars, or in the little lingering wars which have survived it. Hitler and Stalin were not medieval monsters, but our contemporaries. And we ate dinner at our tables while Hiroshima and Auschwitz were burning. We speak confidently of the power of reason. But what is more reasonable than the United Nations, and wherein is its power? We speak encouragingly of the promise of education. What country was better educated than Nazi Germany, and which country has ever been more barbarous? We speak of the benefits of the products of our science. It was our own nation which unleashed that product, that science, to erase cities in the face of the globe. Look up if we dare. But so many of us complain when one reminds him of the sword of Damocles. Why do you want to strip us of our hope? The world's a bitter enough place if we are not encouraged somehow to carry on. Why must we live surrounded by starkness, chill, and the chill and tragedy? The Greek would answer simply, and his answer would be valid. It is this false confidence which precipitates the very doom that you fear. All will be well. Pat the saint on the back and go back to earning a living. Linger over your leisure. We'll somehow muddle through. It is this kind of indolence, indifference, which saps the will of man, which lulls us to sleep until suddenly we are toppled over the abyss. And what virtue is there in living in tragedy? For the Greek, there was the virtue of dignity. He had no use for the whimpering, for the complaining of men. He would have been utterly out of place in our age, which delights to pour out endlessly its petty plaints upon another. We even pay people today to listen to our problems. At least let man wrap himself around in the mantle of his dignity, be proudly strong, and let him walk the way with courage. The poet, essayist, Epictetus put it this way: I must die. Must I die groaning? I must go to prison, but need I complain? I must go into exile. Can I not go with a stout heart and a smile and a peace? Now, there is much to commend this stark philosophy of the Greeks to our bloated age. When so many of us are so engulfed in leisure and abundance and things that we whine and complain at the most trivial of occasions. We are sunk, many of us, in a slough of self-pity. We've expected the world to dance to our tune, to present us all manner of delicacy and present. And when the least bit is missing, someone forgets to pay us a compliment, to ask of our health, to consider our sensibilities. We're embittered. We spend days in plaint. There's much truth in this Greek wisdom, but there is not the fullness of truth. For if there is a sword hanging over our heads, there is also a cornucopia. If the future is a dangerous place, it is also a place of delightful opportunity. The new year is foreboding. It is also full of promise. Now, the Greeks came to their philosophy of resignation and of fortitude because of their concept of evil. They looked upon evil as part of the natural order of things placed in this earth by the gods. One could not escape calamity, war and pestilence and famine and murder most foul and greed and all the rest were inevitable, part of the foreordained pattern of life. Remember the story of Pandora's box? The first men had grown in knowledge. The gods feared that they would be rivaled by their creation. And so Zeus had built this beautiful damoiselle, and he had built this box, and he told Aphrodite,
Pandora to come down to the earth and to spread the word around that this box contained all manner of celestial blessing. But he stamped the box with his seal on which it was said, "The gods forbid its opening." He counted on human curiosity, and sure enough, when Pandora came down and told men that this box contained all manner of divine blessing, man reached for the box and ripped open the lid, and in an instant, all the dark angels had spread across the world. And ever after, man was burdened by all the evils which beset us. Evil was ubiquitous and evil was inevitable. So the Greeks. But to the Jew, evil was accidental. Evil was not God-ordained, but manufactured by man, handcrafted. We are the perpetrators and creators of war. We are the perpetrators and creators of slavery. We are the perpetrators and creators of the burdens under which men groan. Rabbis put it this way. The sword came into the world because of justice being delayed, because of justice being perverted, and because of men who render wrong decisions. Which is another way of saying that the Hough riots occurred this summer because of years and years of pointless meetings downtown, which ended without advance to our city, because of slums and rats, because of the cruelty of men to men, because of inadequate education and lack of opportunity and all the rest that we know all too well. But what man has brutalized, man can civilize. That to the Jew, life was not only a burden to be born, but a gift of God. And the future was not only dark and chill, but throbbing, full of promise. And so the Jewish legend runs this way. When the Jews came out of Egypt and had crossed the Red Sea and achieved their freedom, Moses determined to bring the Jews to the mountain of Revelation, to Sinai. And as the tribes approached Sinai, God suddenly reached down and ripped up the mountain by its roots and held the mountain over the heads of the Jews and said, "Either accept the Torah or the mountain will crush you." Now the image is clear. There's a shadow over our head, a sword, if you will. We have no reason to be confident that mankind will somehow muddle through and we can sort of sit back and relax and wait for that wonderful day. There is danger. War is possible. And the Bible is quite specific. There was a time when God let the mountain fall. In the 6th century before the Common Era, the Judean kingdom became corrupt and venal and idolatrous, and God let the mountain fall, and the people were destroyed, and the remnant was taken into exile. And so it can be with us. But it need not be. A war which will end all wars because it will end mankind is possible, perhaps probable, but it's not inevitable if we accept the Torah. Now, these words are easily said, but the decisions are not easily made. For Torah is not a life of ordinary routine enlightened by a few ritual candles. And Torah, my friends, is not a life of coarseness and rudeness with a once-a-year attendance to promise God repentance. And Torah is not a half-hearted saintliness by weaklings who are timid in their virtues and terrified in their vices. Torah is not the life that most of us lead. But Torah is a life with which we uproot ourselves from indifference and selfishness, and we plant ourselves down again in a world of social concern devoted to justice and to ideals and to the truth. Torah is not a sheltered life, it's a life of action. Torah is deed and not good intentions. Torah is holiness and not banality. Torah is honor and not calculation. Torah is patience with need and impatience with greed. Torah is conviction, strong conviction, and not easy affability. Torah is honor, truth, justice, a life which has dignity and strength and purpose to it. What is Torah for a nation? Torah for a nation is the breaking of swords and not the stockpiling of arms. Torah is the breaking off of battle and not the escalation of war. Torah is the breaking down of prejudice and the breaking down of all that makes for poverty and ignorance and illiteracy, which destroys the dignity of man. Torah is wholesomeness. And a nation devoted to justice for all its people. But it's been the wisdom of our people through the long centuries that we've always understood that ultimately all the political equations are reducible to a moral equation. Either accept the Torah or the mountain will fall upon you. The price of our dreams is a life of discipline and sanctity. And there's no other way. But most of us lack the courage. Most of us prefer the easy way. We reinterpret Torah as convenience, as respectability, as good manners, as good intentions, as being agreeable, as being successful, in whatever terms we will. Now we Jews who stood at Sinai still stand at Sinai. The Torah is over our heads. The shadow of doom can be seen. We Jews, having the tradition we can, certainly cannot be numbered among the grave diggers of civilization. It's not our métier. We are the builders and the teachers. And by God, we ought to be in the forefront of the builders and the teachers. So we have each year this season of renewal, this opportunity for return, for stock-taking, for awareness. Here is the measure, the Torah. Here is the man. How do we measure up? What are we going to do about it? Heshbon HaNefesh. The judgment, the private judgment each man must make of his soul. You come of noble stock. You come from a noble tradition. People have given the vision and the way to mankind. Have the courage to accept it. Rabbi, you say, encourage me. Preach to me words of comfort. There is only one word of comfort I can give you, and that is your own soul. You must be our encouragement. Through your deeds, through your love, through your sacrifice, through your citizenship, through your achievements, through your decency, the mountain will stay firmly in the hand of God. Mankind will slowly become aware of Torah, of the teaching. Men will climb out from under the dark cloud which threatens us, threatens to destroy our world.
pray this night for life, for the full measure of life and more for ourselves and for our children. We pray this night for blessing and for joy in the coming year. May we add a third prayer. For the strength to grasp hold of the teaching which has been for centuries our own, and to live that life which will give our world its hope and its chance.